なるほど。
You are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Michael Sterling.
And I am Paul Strolley.
And you're listening to State of the Arts.
We'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, Breakdown Services, for supporting us this year. Breakdown Services is the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit www.breakdownexpress.com.
That's right. And our thanks also goes out to performingartslive.com for their support of our live arts calendar. Performing Arts Live is the most comprehensive online directory of event information for music, theater, and dance in Southern California.
We'd like to thank. I'm sorry, forgive me. Oh, I'm so excited, Michael. I got to. I had a cold. You know,
I know
so
you did.
I have a little.
Sorry.
I'm a little. My head is a little foggy. Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm also very excited because a personal hero of mine we're going to have on today. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be talking to the legendary Malcolm McDowell, one of the most distinguished actors in motion pictures and television.
Indeed. And in studio with us today, ladies and gentlemen, another fine actor. He's also one of television's most enduring stars, Gerald McCulloch from the hit series CSI. We'll be talking to Gerald about his career and his upcoming opening on stage in Daddy at Hollywood's Hudson Theater just a little bit later in the show today. But welcome, Gerald.
Welcome.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
We're happy to have
you. He's like
here.
You, Michael. He's got those cashmere vocal cords.
He does.
Michael
does,
you know? Michael's working that cashmere
sound.
Vocal.
You think?
Yes, you
okay.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Sometimes I call Michael when I know he's busy just to hear his outgoing message. Hello, this is Michael Sterling. Just, you know, I get, you know, it moves me.
It oh, does. So that's you, is it? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
How was your week, Michael? We talked last week about Christmas-themed things are coming up on the holidays, and do you have any anything to share regarding
Well, you know,
that?
Because that kind of got me thinking, you know, we had an interesting Christmas week, and we had a big show at my supper club last night, which was the first Christmas show of the season, and I did get to thinking, Paul, a little bit about my childhood and a Christmas memory past. And I must have been about 9 years old, actually.
Okay.
Living in Long Beach, beautiful city here in Southern California. And my mom was in the kitchen and was cooking, you know, the Christmas things and whatnot. And my mom wasn't the, excuse me, the most amazing cook in the world, but she certainly was a good cook. And
right.
I loved her food. And the stove caught on fire. And it was, I mean, it was pretty awesome, actually. I mean, I remember thinking, God, that's really wicked. You know, but the flames are going higher than the stove.
Did you grab some chestnuts by the open fire?
Well, you know, it crossed my mind.
It
crossed my mind, but something more important. Something more important crossed my mind. And I you know, the fire department was called, and people were rushing, our neighbors rushing in front of the house, you know, 15, 20 people, and all concerned and gazing up at the house. And I went out onto the porch, and in my most professional manner,
right,
made an announcement, thanked everybody for coming, first of all. and to me, you know, the 15, 20 people was like 500 or 600 in my mind's eye.
Right.
And made this very eloquent speech that my mother had inadvertently, you know, I don't think I used that word at nine, but had started a fire in the kitchen, and the house, it was a horrible fire, actually, and that the house was going to burn down. And then I was pleased to say that we would be moving from this house into a much larger and better home in a better neighborhood. Yeah. So that was my statement, and I said thank you and good night. And I went in.
9 years old.
Yeah.
And if I know you, Michael, at nine, you had a smoking jacket on.
Well, close to it, then. Yeah.
Well, smoking in this case.
You know, I don't know. That was a Christmas memory, though. That occurred to me on the way here today.
I don't have a Christmas memory right now, but I do have something that I stumbled across on the internet that is just so surreal that I just felt a need to share this. This was from London's Daily Mail from November 15th. Britain's National Health Service acknowledged in November that because of a shortage of healthy lungs and other organs available for transplant, it was offering those on waiting lists the option of receiving them from former smokers, drug addicts, and the elderly.
Equal opportunity.
This is absolutely true, which seems to me it would just make for a very bittersweet phone call, because it would sort of be like, okay, the good news is we got you a liver. The bad news is it's Ted Kennedy's.
You'll be drunk when you receive it.
Right, exactly.
You'll be drunk for the next 10 years.
You know, it's funny that you say that. A friend of mine actually had a bone marrow transplant a few years back and ended up with allergies that he didn't have beforehand because of where that information is apparently stored.
Oh, wow.
So he wasn't allergic to cats. So he got a bone marrow transplant, and now he's allergic to cats.
There's a joke in there somewhere.
There is. He's allergic to Cats the Musical. Yes, only.
There you go. Bada bing.
Bada bing. Well, very, very excited about our upcoming guest. He remains one of the most dynamic and inventive, a world-class actor since he catapulted to fame in Stanley Kubrick's darkly satirical classic, A Clockwork Orange, and the Candide-like masterpiece, Oh, Lucky Man. I believe we have him on the line right now. We're welcoming Mr. Malcolm McDowell.
Thank you, and hello.
Yes, hello,
that's
Mr. McDowell.
Very funny story. A very funny story about the the fire in the kitchen.
Well, thank
which
you.
Which is very reminiscent of Dylan Thomas, of course, A Child's Christmas in Wales, which is really why I'm here with you today. But it was almost a carbon copy.
Are you serious?
Hilarious.
Oh, my goodness, I didn't know that. I know the work, but I don't know it that well. Forgive me. And Paul Strolley here, it's one of his very favorite pieces.
I'm a huge fan of Dylan Thomas, Mr. McDowell, and I did a production of Under Milkwood several years ago in Chicago that was very, very successful. It was a wonderful, wonderful production. And but we're very interested to hear about A Child's Christmas in Wales. Now, this is sort of an additional presentation for this, in addition to an opera that's being performed. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, this is, I think, opens the evening. I haven't actually rehearsed it yet, but I'm opening the evening with narrating A Child's Christmas in Wales, which, by the way, I hadn't read it in many, many years, so I've just revisited it again. And I have to say that it is one of the most spectacular and beautiful descriptions of Christmas that I've ever read.
It truly is.
And we all know that Dylan Thomas, of course, was a genius of sorts. I mean, of course, a drunk as well. But through all that, the descriptions of Christmas of his childhood is spectacular. And I would urge anyone, it's worth a read, because it's so delicious, and you really are transported back in time, I suppose, to the early 40s or something, or even earlier, I suppose the 30s, wouldn't he be? It would be 30s for him. But anyway, quite an absolutely the beautiful prose that seemed to flow naturally out of him, you know.
And oddly enough, so rarely offered. I think holiday times come around, and we have, you know, we usually have our 15 different versions of the Christmas Carol to choose from.
Right, but, I know. Well,
A Child's Christmas,
you know,
in Wales.
This is, I'm doing it simply because, you know, I don't know, we're doing it at the Pasadena Playhouse, and you may have known, I'm sure you do, probably know it more than I, that they had a bit of financial problems of late, or last year, where they declared bankruptcy, I believe.
Right.
And so when I was asked to do this, I jumped at the chance, because I do believe that we need the Pasadena Playhouse in L.A.
In every way,
because
yes.
It's something worth fighting for, and, you know, we don't have that many traditions here in theatrical traditions, and that is certainly one of them. And so any help, you know, that one can give, then one should give it. And it has such a great tradition, and so many great actors have worked there and trodden those boards, you know, and it's a beautiful theater. So I was really happy to just to say, absolutely, I'll do whatever, you know, just to help, just give a helping hand, you know.
Well, you're in on the ground floor over there. You know, Sheldon Epps, their artistic director, has been amazingly proactive in working with the board and securing what is now a $2 million fund, which is reigniting.
Wow, well, that's so exciting for them. And so maybe out of this sort of disaster came really good things. You know, sometimes it takes that.
Exactly.
Let's hope that our economy has the same effect.
I agree with you. Well, we're still looking forward to the what you're doing there with the Dylan Thomas poem, which really kind of, it documents a very familiar and warm memory of family traditions, right?
Yes, exactly. You know, and he lived in a seaside town where all he remembers about Christmas, of course, was heavy snow. And so I'm thinking, my God, will it must have been something to do with climate change or something, because I was raised in Liverpool, which is not that far. It's on the west coast, and it's just a bit further north than Wales, the Welsh coast. So I'm thinking, well, I don't remember too many snowed-in Christmases, but there was one or two, and I think it must have been just one that was really, that he was so firm in his memory.
Well,
but, you know, some of the way he describes it is magical, and, of course, only somebody like, you know, only Dylan Thomas could have used this prose and this sort of beautiful English language, but coming from a Welshman, which has a certain poetic lilt to it.
Sure, yeah.
Which is really beautiful, and, you know... the ideal person to do it would be, of course, Tony Hopkins or Richard Burton. You know, I can hear Richard Burton's voice doing it because, of course, he was from Wales, as is Anthony, and that's the perfect accent for it. But I'll give it my best imitation of a Welsh accent.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mentioned Under Milkwood earlier, and the most famous of the BBC recordings of Under Milkwood is Richard Burton. But one of the things I found to be just astounding, because, you know, not only to be impressed by Dylan Thomas's work as a poet, but to hear his BBC recordings of himself reading his own work, I mean, they're staggering. I mean, the man's voice was just, I mean, he makes Richard Burton sound like Phyllis Diller. I mean, he has a voice.
Well,
I mean, he has that you talk about that lilt and that sort of that cadence and that ringing at the end of the lines, because, you know, who knows better of their own inflection than the composer of the line, you know?
Well, I know there's a recording of him doing this, which I haven't heard, and I have a good mind not to hear it, because if I do, I'll feel totally inadequate. So I just thought that I would do my own thing, you know. I was brought up near enough in Wales, right on the border.
Right.
I used to go to holidays, you know, in a little cottage in North Wales, and I always loved Wales. I've always loved the Welsh. I've always loved Welsh actors and singers. And, you know, and to hear the rugby teams in Wales and the singing choirs at Cardiff Arms Park and all that, you know, it's very moving, and just love the people, who are totally and utterly as different from the English as you can possibly get.
Now wait a minute, though. Was that a thinly veiled slam on the English there? Because you just praised the Welsh to the skies and then said they're the opposite of the English.
I'll just let you be the judge of that. I don't want to knock my fellow Brits at this time, but because it is the season of good cheer. But I love the Welsh because, you know, they're so emotional, and I love that about a people. I'm not so keen on that, and it's not all English, by the way, but there's a certain Southern English superiority that some of the upper classes have, you know, that is still very ingrained even today, I think, and you know, that's what I really don't miss about living in England, I must say. But there's lots of things I do miss. And one of them, you know, is going into the West End of London and especially at this time of the year, that all the, you know, the plays that are on and the theater land and the whole thing, it just it brings back memories for me.
It's a wonderful place to be around the holidays.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It really is.
There's a book. There's a wonderful book called Caitlin about Dylan Thomas's wife, Caitlin Thomas.
Yeah.
And it's an astonishing read, because right after he passed, she wrote actually a book called Leftover Life to Kill, which gives you some idea how she took his demise. So Leftover Life to Kill was the first book that she wrote. But Caitlin was the follow-up biography of her, autobiography that she wrote with another gentleman. And Mr. McDowell, you mentioned the passion earlier of the people, and I don't know of any book where it leaps off the page as much as it does in this biography. It's a wonderful, wonderful read. And if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it, because I think you
will. I will program it in the Kindle as soon as.
Ah, there you go. Mr. McDowell, our listeners, you know, are thrilled to have you with us today, so that they're listening very intently. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the beginnings of your fame in motion pictures and the amazing work that you did in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. Did you have any idea at that time when you were doing this film that this would lead to a career of 40 years of being one of the most distinguished actors, certainly, that we have in film?
Well, look, you know, of course one always hopes. Because my hero, weirdly enough, other than Jimmy Cagney, who worked pretty much until the day he died, by the way, even though he retired, but he did come back and did Ragtime.
Right.
But my hero, the man I wanted to emulate, was Sir John Gielgud. I always adored John, and I loved his work. I thought he was an absolutely brilliant actor. And I didn't ever try to copy him in his acting style or anything, but I just admired him tremendously for his, you know, brilliant way that he adapted himself through the generations. Because when he started, it was really all the voice, you know, just this poetic voice. And when he came, he worked with Olivier. You know, they did Romeo and Juliet, where they played one night one would do Romeo and the other Mercutio, and then they'd swap roles the next performance. And he said to me, actually, John, you know, he said, "Oh, Larry was so much more athletic than me. I just had a voice. He had everything. He was so extraordinary. You couldn't take your eyes off him. He was absolutely brilliant." And he would go on and on and about Larry, you know. But of course, what was great about John was that he almost learned how to act on film late in his life. You know, I think the first time I really saw him giving a very modern performance on film was when he did Tony Richardson film of Charge of the Light Brigade, and he was so brilliant in it. And then, of course, I got to work with him, and as I did the great three nights, you know, Gielgud, Richardson, and Olivia. So that was an extraordinary beginning for me to work with these giants, you know. And the extraordinary thing was that the three of them were contemporaries, you know. Normally, the great actors like this come along once every 100 years or so, you know, like David Garrick, you know. But this was three of the same generation. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, that was the planets were in alignment. What an education that must have been for you.
Mm. Extraordinary, yeah.
And then you went on to do Oh Lucky Man and Time After Time with Mary Steenburgen, I believe it was.
Yes, yes. We got two children out of that one. But that was a lot of fun doing that. I loved it. And, you know, we fell in love shooting. It's just a cardinal sin, of course, for an actor is to actually fall in love with his leading lady. But there you are. The planets were aligned yet again. And we had the most wonderful time on that movie, and a very romantic time. And, you know, it was directed by and written by Nick Meyer. And we shot it in San Francisco, which was very romantic. And it, you know, also starred my old chum from way back at Stratford days, David Warner, who was brilliant as Jack the Ripper.
Yes.
So that was a lot of fun. But, you know, I've been very lucky with my career. And but, you know, of course, along the way, there have been some absolute turds, you know.
That's a nice way to put it.
You know, listen, I'm a working actor, really.
Well, Mr. McDowell, it's a... My hopes are very, very high for your performance with the Dylan Thomas piece, A Child's Christmas in Wales, because...
We know that's not going to be a turd because we've got Dylan Thomas to save us.
No, but my point was that you just uttered the word turds with such eloquence that once you have Dylan Thomas to work with... before we forget, though, and we want to make sure we include this, is to let people know where this is happening and how they can see it. So Malcolm McDowell's appearance with the Intimate Opera Company of Pasadena, California, who will be presenting Giancarlo Menotti's classic holiday opera, Amahl and the Night Visitors, with mezzo-soprano Susanna Guzman at the historic Pasadena Playhouse for 5 performances only, beginning this Thursday, December 16th through Saturday, December 19th.
Sunday, December 19th.
Oh, I'm sorry, through Sunday, December 19th.
Yeah, through Sunday.
On December 16th at 8, December 17th at 8, December 18th at 2 and 8, and December 19th at 2 p.m. Mr. McDowell will narrate A Child's Christmas in Wales by Welsh poet Dylan Thomas after the conclusion of Amahl and the Night Visitors during the week's evening performances. So, Michael, would you give the ticket information?
Indeed, I will, Paul. Thanks. Tickets are now available online at intimateopera.net. And for patrons interested in attending the December 16th gala opening and dinner with the artists and creative team following that night's performance, should call area code 626-274-7342.
Now, Mr. McDowell, we ask all of our guests to share a memory. We will ask our in-studio guest to do the same thing, Geralt, when we get to him shortly. But we always ask people to share their most embarrassing or awkward or nightmarish experience while performing. Do any of those memories come readily to you?
Yes, absolutely. I've got quite a few, actually, but I'll give you the first one.
Okay.
I was a young actor at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and we were appearing. I was walking on, basically, moving furniture, which is what you do when you first join the company. And so I was doing a production of Henry V, which starred the great Ian Holm, who was one of the great Henry V's I'd ever seen. He was brilliant. Anyway, it was halfway through the run, and apparently the English Herald was off. He was sick or something, and so was his understudy. I was sitting in the pub when the assistant stage manager came in and said, "Anybody know the English Herald?" And I sort of said, "What, you mean, my sovereign lord, bestow yourself with speed, the French are bravely in their battle set, and will with all expedience charge on us?" She went, "That's it, you're playing it." I said, "Really? Well, this is my first lines in the West End." She said, "Good, well, you're on." So, of course, I was waiting for this moment. I had to do all my other duties, moving carts, fires, whatever it was, and the scene before the Agincourt speech, which this herald leads into, is a night scene where Henry is praying for success on the field. It's, "O God of battle, steel my soldiers' hearts,"
right,
and all that. And so I'm in the wings with my tabard and my flag, and suddenly a green light goes on, and these trumpets, which I'd never heard before for some reason, these trumpets, and somebody sort of shoved me on. So I ran on with this flag and started waving and said, "My sovereign lord, bestow yourself with speed, the French. Come on, come on, they're waiting." To which the whole of the Agincourt army turned back to the audience to face me and literally heaved laughter for like a minute and a half. I thought I was going to disappear, you know. And anyway, that was my embarrassing moment, and luckily my career survived it.
Oh, classic.
Oh, one more time. Thank you for sharing that. That was amazing. And ladies and gentlemen, one more time, you can see this amazing actor reciting a child's Christmas in Wales at the Pasadena Playhouse, December 16th through the 19th. Just visit them online at intimateopera.net or call for tickets. Area code 626-274-7342. Thank you, Malcolm McDowell, for joining us.
Thank you, sir. A pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye now.
All the best. Merry Christmas.
And to you.
Same to you.
Oh, that was great.
He's terrific.
Yeah, you know what? I think he gets applause.
Just out there in the lobby again.
You know, it's interesting because I watched, the Clockwork Orange so much in college when I was impaired that's probably the most logical I've been with in anything involving Malcolm McDowell. In
that. Really? Wow. A testament to a fine actor.
All right.
To two fine actors. You're included in that, Paul.
Let's burn through our live arts calendar, shall we?
Indeed.
So we can get to our next guest.
The renowned Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles pulls out the stops with two matinees and one evening performance of its annual holiday musical extravaganza Saturday, December 18th and Sunday, December 19th at the Alex Theater in Glendale, California. Some 150 choir members resplendent in holiday finery will do Santa proud with a bundle of beloved seasonal works and a dazzling 12 Days of Christmas black light puppet spectacular. The concert extravaganza, which kicks off the choir's 32nd season, country music legend Leanne Rimes joins in, and Tony Award-nominated Broadway star Cheryl Lee Ralph from Broadway's original company of Dreamgirls are special guests.
And still thrilling audiences for more than 40 years, recording and concert star Andy Williams brings his spectacular Christmas show to Michael, why do you give me the tough
things? I loved that album as a kid.
Segrist album.
Oh my gosh.
The Andy Williams?
Yes.
Oh yeah, and you know he's got that. You know he's got the like you. The velvet voice, you know?
Mr. Williams, yes. Wow.
But no, what I was getting to, is it Segerstrom?
Segerstrom.
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 He gives himself the easy stuff, and he throws me this. Segerstrom Concert Hall, part of the Orange County Performing Arts Center in Costa Mesa, California. The iconic crooner's quintessential interpretation of It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year highlights this presentation. Would you underscore this?
I could.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Sure, go ahead.
Go ahead.
In the background. Very nice.
Go ahead.
It's the most
highlights this presentation by the Pacific Symphony Pops Orchestra. The concert also features other Williams hits, including Moon River, Music to Watch Girls By, Can't Get Used to Losing You, and The Days of Wine and Roses, which is what that sounded like just then. It sounded like The Days of Wine and Roses, didn't it?
It did, indeed. And for more information, of course, about these wonderful productions that are out there in this Christmas holiday time period, simply go to performingartslive.com or to, of course, the show's website, our website,
stateoftheartsla.com. stateoftheartsla. And before we talk to Geralt, who is with us as the second half of our hour, I do want to ask you, Michael, about Anthony Field's performance at Sterling's Upstairs at Vitello's this past weekend.
Well, thank you for bringing it up, actually. Anthony was kicking it off there last night with a band of five behind him in a beautiful show that was the CD release party of his new album, which is called You and Me on Christmas Eve. And
You and Me specifically, or is it called Michael and Paul on Christmas Eve? Because I'm not getting a check, and I want to know what this is
about. The royal You and Me.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. It was a stunning evening. I mean, high energy. The place was packed and, you know, ready for this kind of a kickoff for the holiday season. And Anthony is one of those smooth, golden, dulcet, toned voiced guys, you know. I mean, he's
so smooth. His name doesn't even have an H. It's Anthony.
Anthony.
Yes.
Anthony.
Drop the H.
Looks like a young Bobby Darin on top of it, which is pretty awesome. But he sings to beat the bejesus, and the crowd was loving every second of it. Couldn't have gotten enough of it. It wasn't entirely all Christmas music, which is all brand new, which he has written with his partner Chip Smith, the amazing Chip Smith, and his quintet. And it was interspersed with wonderful standards from the Great American Songbook. So it was an awesome evening.
And you said it was packed to the rafters.
Packed to the rafters.
That's great.
So another show, real quickly, I just want to acknowledge Leslie Margarita, who is a wonderful, wonderful musical theater star here in Los Angeles and also in the West End in London, and was the recipient of an Olivier Award. And she did her big holiday show at Level 3 in the Kodak Entertainment Complex there on Highland and Hollywood Boulevard.
Oh, is that a club there?
It's a club, yes. Oh, okay. It's a big discotheque, actually.
I'm going to guess it's on the third floor.
It would be. Yeah. You are right, sir. And this girl just, nice. I mean, she knocks it out of the park vocally. She's got this wonderful, hilarious sense of humor. The title of the show was All Hail the Queen, Hail Yes. And the opening number was a Christmas tune, Come Let Us Adore Her. Adore Her. So that was, it'll give you a taste of where she was going with that. But if you ever have a chance to see Leslie Margarita in concert, make sure you do it. It's a night you won't forget very soon.
Okay. Yeah. And at the end of the hour, when we're all done, I believe Anthony Field is going to play us off the air with one of the tracks from his new CD.
He is indeed.
Okay. As Michael said earlier, he's one of television's most enduring stars, a superb actor. He has portrayed firearms technician Bobby Dawson on CSI for 10 seasons now, and beginning January 8th, he will recreate his starring role in the off-Broadway hit Daddy at Hollywood's Hudson Theater. Please welcome Gerald McCulloch with the show.
Gerald. You say tomato, I say tomato.
I have said Gerald all day in anticipation of this. The first time I say your name, I say Gerald. I'm so sorry. But I'll drown it out with applause.
Oh, there we go. Hey,
Gerald. Okay. That was subliminal. Well, we met just a little while ago, Gerald, and I was asking you how much of an albatross the pronunciation of your first name is.
It has been a lifelong journey. It's so funny. My mom, I live in New York and LA. I go back and forth. My mom came and stayed with me last year in New York. I'd gotten a little subway incident that kind of made some news.
I read about that. You were arrested for something.
No. I was the good guy. Some guy tried to steal my laptop and brought out a 10-inch kitchen knife and tried to stab me. And
what?
Yeah, I box.
Shut the front door. Really?
And I had just landed in New York from LA, and I had just gotten out of the boxing ring with my coach. I went from the ring with my coach to home to get my bags to go to the airport. So when he went after my laptop, just instinctually and probably stupidly, I defended myself, and he brought out a knife, and I had to continue to defend myself. And there was some repercussions to that whole situation. A mom came and stayed with me afterwards. And about the third day of her staying with me, she saw me go through this. Well, it's like Gerald, but it's like Gerald, but it has a hard G. It's Gerald. She got to see me do this time and time again, and finally she went, oh, I'm sorry. Well, she's a Southern Belle. She's like, oh, Gerald, I'm so sorry.
Well, I knew it had to be an issue, because that's what you named your production
company. It is. Yeah, Hard G Productions and Hard G Properties and everything. Yeah.
Well, God bless her.
It's so funny because when friends start hanging out with me for a while, they'll see me have to do this all the time when I meet people. They're like, oh, my God, you have to do that all the time. And I'm like, I know.
Well, I'm thinking about what you just said, and I'm trying to think about the unluckiest thing in the world, and that would probably be mugging someone who's coming home from their boxing lesson.
Yeah, you know, it was an out of body experience. It was life changing. It was It was pretty amazing. Not amazing in a good way. But I didn't really grasp the whole situation until I read about it in the paper a couple of days later, which I didn't know it was going to be blown out of proportion the way it was, or have such ramifications that it did. But he was 6'3" and 240 pounds. I don't know what I was doing thinking I could defend myself against him, but my instincts.
But no, I don't want to pry too much, and please don't forgive me if I am. But were you injured? Were you cut? I mean, you said your mom came in. Did she come in to because you were convalescing? Or,
yeah, it wasn't. The press never let on, but yeah, I did get cut in my on my chin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had about four or five stitches.
Chilling. Yeah.
But luckily, when he tried to stab me in the back, it did not puncture.
And did anybody else on the subway come to your assistance or
do you
try
know that
to
I
come
love
to your assistance?
New York. I love that city. And sadly, no one helped.
So why am
Everyone
I not surprised?
Ran from the subway car. No one helped at all. Yeah. It was really
don't get involved.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, yeah. That was the one thing that was a little disenchanting.
Yeah, that's a it's one of those things where I have this whole thing about New York and L.A. and the way that I describe it, and it's obviously not in all cases, but it's like New York is warm, but not friendly. And L.A. is friendly, but not warm.
Well, not true. New Yorkers are so friendly. New York is such an amazing and friendly city. But I think people
Oh, no, my point is that once you get past that, there's a warmth to be found.
Yes.
But on the initial contact, you'll be walking down the street in New York, and you'll have to be about 4 feet away from people before you realize that they're not arguing, they're just having a conversation.
or they're on their cell phone.
Yeah.
Oh, they're not crazy, they're just talking to somebody on the cell phone.
Right, exactly.
Oh, sorry.
Well, in the words of the immortal Lily Tomlin, she said, wouldn't it be great if all the people who wandered the streets of New York talking to themselves could be paired off so they could walk around in couples and look like they're having a conversation.
Sweet.
So, Gerald, tell us about this production. It's the second time you've...
Daddy is a really beautiful and hilarious play written by Dan Vaya. And I did this play earlier in New York this year. We opened in January. And it was received really well. I was... really blown away by the critics and what they had to say, not only about the show but about the performances, and it was just such an amazing journey and received so well, and I'm so glad that it's coming to LA and that we're able to do it. Dan is creating his role as well as I am, and then we have four new LA actors also appearing in the show.
Oh, okay, so it's a cast of six.
Basically a story of three people, and Rick Sparks, the director, who's doing such a great job. And I've got to say, it's really nice to come back into a story that I'm familiar with, and because of a new director, see it through completely new eyes and find new stuff and find a new way to tell the story. And it's been a really great journey, and I'm really looking forward to the production.
That's interesting, though. Do you find yourself protective at all of your last portrayal with a new director, you having done the show before? How does an actor cope with that?
I don't. You know, and Rick and I talked about that previously. But to finish the previous thought, Rick, to fill out the story, it is a three-person story, but to fill out the story, he has brought in three other actors just to create more of an ambiance to the piece and to the different environments when the story moves from a bar to my office. There's people around to fill out the story.
Okay.
But yeah, coming to the story in a new production, Rick and I did have a conversation, and to me, the only reason that would be a problem would be someone's ego getting in the way. And if all of our common goal is to tell the story, then I have no reason to compare how it's being told now to how it was told previously. So it's been a great experience, and through some of his direction, I've grasped and seen some things that I overlooked before, and that's been a great experience as an actor, to come back into a story that you told 8 months ago for a few months or a month in New York, and to realize and see things that you overlooked that you completely, you know, had no idea you were overlooking.
And it sounds like it's a distinctly different production with three new characters.
Yeah, it really is. Exactly, I think visually it's completely different, and I think how Rick is tapping into some of the themes of Dan's writing is different. I think it's maybe a more mature way of telling the story. I think Dan has written a really hilariously beautiful and original piece about two middle-aged... Oh, my God. I just said I was middle-aged. Can we erase that?
We'll fix it in post.
Can we fix that in post?
Yeah. He's a chameleon. God. He's 22 years old.
I'm now leaving. No. Two middle-aged gay men navigating their friendship and what happens when a much younger man comes in between them. And I think Dan's kind of acerbic wit and his sense of humor brings to life a friendship that really hasn't been seen before, that I've never experienced before in things I've seen or plays or movies I've read or seen. And I'm honored to bring that to life.
It's a very funny play, and it's also a very dark side to it as well.
It is. It's hilarious. I think Dan's grasp for how these people communicate and what is not said and what is said is so true to life. It just really breathed with the audience in New York. People really gravitated toward the show, and the response was amazing, and I hope it's the same in LA. And through that humor, just like in life sometimes, something kind of slaps you across the face, and you're kind of forced to see things through new eyes, and sometimes that's a little overwhelming.
Where did you do it in New York?
We did it at the Barrow Group. We did it... Michael Urey had been doing the Temperamentals at the Barrow Group before they moved to the New World Stages, and we took over when they left.
Oh, okay.
How long did you run there in New York?
I think that it was a limited run. So Equity and the type of contract we did, I know we ran for under a month, and I can't remember with previews and I think it was a 3.5 week run. It may have been just a month. I'm sorry. I came from one job to that job and left and did another job after that. So
we're really grilling him about this. Could we have a map to the theater
on January 2nd at 3:15?
Do you remember what you had to eat the first
Thursday? What were you wearing the first time you stopped by Subway?
There was something else I was going to ask you about working with the playwright. What is that? I mean, the playwright is one of the performers.
Dan is one of is my co-star, yes.
And how the change of adding these additional characters, obviously there was textual changes that had to take place to introduce these characters. And how is it to work with, it's just interesting to me to work not only to do a show that you've done before, but to be working with the playwright both times. That has to be a gift that, could be a gift or it could be a hindrance depending on who your playwright is.
Yeah,
but it sounds like it was a gift.
It is a gift. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know Dan at all until I came to this project. And so the first rehearsal process, which was the first time the play was done, and there was a continual rewrites, but that's just par for the course, and I wasn't creatively involved in any of that. And now that I've come to the piece, having done it before, Dan and I do communicate more about stuff like that, but again, that's more a conversation that he and Rick has.
Gotcha.
You know, I'm an actor, and
gotcha.
It's not my job to jump into Dan's world. it's a story he created. He's told a beautiful story, and I have, complete reverence for how he's told it.
And you're helping him tell it.
Yeah. I'm honored to be doing so.
Yeah.
Well, we should tell everybody that's listening to this. It sounds like it's something that people should see for sure. I know I would like to see it, and Paul, I'm sure you would too. And performances of Daddy take place Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Sundays at 7 p.m. January 8th through February 13th. There are three preview performances, I might add, on Wednesday, January 5th, and Thursday, Friday, January 7th at 8 p.m. And tickets to all performances are $30, except previews, which are half price, $15. And you can't beat that. The Hudson Main Stage Theater is located at 6539 Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood, California. For reservations and information, call area code 323-960-7738 or go to plays411.com/daddy.
I just love a dark comedy. Dark comedies are hard to find, and even harder to pull off well, and this sounds like it's right up my alley.
Rather than a dark comedy, it's more of a a comedy with kind of a twist of...
Okay, yeah, a comedy with sort of dark moments.
Dark moments, yes. Or
okay.
So a climactic darkness.
Okay, there you go.
That's a great laugh he has, huh? A great laugh. Very contagious,
very
I'm sure.
Infectious.
Yes,
yeah.
If anyone that knows me is listening, they will agree that I'm always, my laugh is always something people comment on.
A signature for you. Tell us about your life on television. So 10 years with CSI? Wow.
I'm honored to have been part of it. It's been great. I actually, Carol Mundelson, who is the executive producer, I went from doing the last season of Melrose Place directly into CSI. She was also the showrunner on Melrose Place, and just through chance, she happened to be the CSI showrunner as well. It's been an amazing journey. We had no idea. I did the very first episode. I've been misquoted in press saying that I did the pilot, which I didn't do, but I did do the very first episode, and we had no idea at that time what was going to happen with the show, and for it to have been the ride that it's been has been life changing and has been amazing. It's I'm honored to have been included in this.
And you mentioned before that Melrose Place, a recurring role on Melrose Place.
Yeah, I did the last season of Melrose Place.
And also Beverly Hills 902. 1-0, right?
Yeah, right before I did Beverly Hills, right before Melrose Place, I did the last season of 90210. Then the last season. Is that bad luck? It's like, hey, let's bring Gerald on. let's end the show with Gerald. I did the last season of 90210, then the last season of Melrose Place, and then I went into CSI.
And then I was on last season of Happy Days, where I jumped the shark.
And maybe the last season of
State of the Arts.
State of the Arts. We hope not.
Oh, great.
No. Thanks a lot, Gerald.
Oh, man.
You and that name of yours.
Well, we have to initate Gerald as well.
As we did with Malcolm McDowell.
Exactly.
Do you have a story?
I do have a story. I've told the story before. This story is embarrassing. So I was, before I moved to LA, I was in New York, and I my last big job in New York was I played Jesus in the European tour of Jesus Christ Superstar, which was incredible. It was a great experience.
Can I underscore you now while you tell the story?
Which one?
Go ahead.
And so we were in Frankfurt, and I believe we opened in Frankfurt, and we were in a very nice hotel with a nice spa downstairs. And the Germans have a different way to experience the spa in the fact that it's, you know, not segregated between male and female.
Right.
And, you know, everyone walks around naked. So, you know, that was kind of new to us Americans that were there. And I think I want to say it was Christmas Eve.
At least the water's warm. You have to be happy.
Another Christmas memory, Paul. Another Christmas memory.
So, you know, I didn't know this, but and no one really spoke English, but there are certain places you can be nude and certain places you can't be nude. I didn't know that. So, you know, it was kind of odd that everyone's, you know, in the sauna, nude. And I'm like, okay, I guess, you know, go along to get along, you know, drop the robe out, you know. And then I'm like, all right. And so I walk, you know, through the little area between the sauna and one of the jacuzzis. And as I get into the jacuzzi, naked, you know, this woman stands up and blows a little whistle and starts yelling at me. And everyone stops. It's like the music stops and everyone looks at me, naked, getting into the jacuzzi. I'm like, what? And then in German, she's yelling at me. And I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. Naked, naked. No. Ends up, the jacuzzi, you cannot get in naked. You have to wear something. So I was forced out of the jacuzzi naked with everybody staring at me, not knowing what everyone was looking at other than, that was my moment.
Little
that
G. Was my, they were looking at little G.
Little G. Hard G. It was not a hard G.
They were looking at
it.
They went to see Jesus and they saw Judas too. There you go.
Ba-dum-bum. Good night and Merry Christmas.
So you must have, that was a great story, but you must have another one, right? When you were actually on stage and something.
That's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good. That's a pretty good related story.
No, I'm trying to think about. Well, just I'm just imagining the whole idea of, you know, just like I'm here.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to embrace the culture.
No.
Because all these Americans, they come to these European countries
and
they're the ugly Americans and they judge.
That.
Not me.
I will
not
be
me.
One of them. I will be one of them. Yes,
I'm going
do this.
To absorb their culture by getting. Arrested
I have
for indecent
nothing to
exposure.
Be ashamed of. Why is everyone staring at me? Why is she blowing that whistle? What is happening? Should I keep going in the jacuzzi? I guess I should just stand here. Why is everyone still looking at me? What is happening?
I think the why that's so hysterical is because while all of this is happening, your mind is just going, I don't know why these people are. What's going on behind me?
I have nothing. My hands are on my hip. I have nothing to be ashamed of. Is it my tattoo? Oh, memories.
I did Jesus in Jesus Christ Superstar too.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
You did.
The all-nude production.
Oh,
yes.
Well, then. I didn't know there was such a thing.
Yes, it was.
I did not do
hey,
Jesus.
Hosanna!
Hosanna! Hey, Zana!
Gerald, you're from the South originally?
I'm a little bit country, a little bit rock and roll.
Okay.
I've moved all over America my whole life. I moved every 2 years of my life. And
okay.
I've actually lived in L.A. the longest. I lived here... before I bought my place in New York 4 years ago, I lived here for 14 years, I think. And I've been bicoastal for the last four.
Oh, okay.
So L.A. and New York are kind of my homes.
The only reason I say is because the only time I heard anything even remotely Southern was naked.
Naked. Oh, naked. I do say naked. There are certain... I say y'all and naked. Those are my Southern euphemisms I have continued to...
Which is the N-E-K-K-I-D.
Or is that N-E-K-I-D.
N-E-K-I-D.
Naked. Naked. Just downcore, hardcore, yeah. Naked.
Michael has a... Michael's
a naked story?
Well, he's had to tell it a couple of times, but it's close to naked story, but it's your... It's your story of doing your costume change and not really being able to pull it off, as it were.
Really want me to? Well,
I don't know the story, so I guess you better tell.
Very young boy in a major production, Bye Bye Birdie, Dick Van Dyke.
Which proves to be a prophetic title by the end of this.
What was his
Bye Bye Birdie?
Dick's name used to be what?
Oh yeah, Dick Van Dyke. Yes, formerly Penis Von Lesbian.
Yes, that's right.
Well,
that's
really?
Right. Yeah.
And he's got a
few
show right now, The Geffen.
It's coming. I actually had to cancel.
They had to cancel. Oh. There was a thing on CBS Sunday morning about it. He hurt his Achilles tendon, and they had to cancel.
It is being rescheduled, though.
Love Dick Van Dyke. He is amazing.
It looked fantastic on the CBS Sunday morning, and he's 85. He's 86.
Yeah. No, he's amazing.
Yeah.
He's pretty amazing.
He's iconic.
Probably don't have enough time, really, Paul, to tell that story
okay.
this time.
But, that's all right.
I don't want to rob Anthony of his due here as he takes us out.
Okay,
bit,
and
but,
we'll...
I get the story after we take it.
You that. Will.
Right. And we'll also announce next week what we can which episode they need to listen to hear it, because it's on a past broadcast, isn't it?
It
You're
is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so we will listen to... this is Anthony Field on, I believe, the track is Let's Get the Christmas Tree?
It is, but before we do that, Paul, let's, excuse me, thank, of course, our guest today, and announce next week's guest, James Rodet, co-star of the USA Network TV series Psych, now entering its sixth season, and Brad Rader, television and film actor, and co-founder with James Rodet of the Red Dog Squadron Theater Company in Los Angeles.
And that is next week. So we will look forward to seeing you then, and now we will sign off with Mr. Anthony Field.
Grab your coat and come along for a ride. It's snowing still and it's cold outside. Hop in the seat, sit next to me. Let's get the Christmas tree. We arranged all the furniture. Checked it twice, yes, and I made sure it would fit nice and easily. Let's get the Christmas tree. Light shining bright when it is night, waiting for some presents to surround it. Kids hope they might steal a sight of Santa as he tiptoes around it. Noble fir or a pine to choose, take your pick, there's no way to lose. Either way is okay for me. Let's get the Christmas tree.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.